Dr. Kavi Bala, who is an assistant professor at the International Injury Research Unit at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Dr. Bala's research aims to develop transport systems that are safe, sustainable, and equitable, with a central focus on road safety in low and middle income countries.
Good afternoon. My name is Kavi Bala, and I will be talking about the evaluation of an interval-based speed enforcement system for road safety in China. An interval-based speed enforcement system is a speed camera system. I do not have any relationships to disclose. Okay, so the goal is to evaluate the effectiveness of an interval-based speed enforcement system. By effectiveness, I mean effectiveness at reducing vehicle speeds. Now, I'm sure this crowd knows very well the importance of reducing speeds for road safety, so I'm not going to talk about that very much. But I'm talking about effectiveness at reducing speeds. I'm not, unfortunately, going to talk about effectiveness at reducing accidents, because we don't have that sort of data from this study. The interval-based enforcement system is a type of speed camera system that I will be talking about in a little bit. And Dalian, China, is a city on the east coast. In 2012, it had a population of 4.2 million people with about 240 deaths annually. The city has a GDP per capita that's about twice that of China, so it's a rich-ish sort of city. It's definitely not one of the richest cities on the east coast of China, which is where all the wealth of China lies. You might be wondering what we are doing in Dalian, China. Why Dalian? So Dalian is one of the two cities in China where the Road Safety in 10 Countries project is currently conducting road safety interventions. The RS10 project, which is Road Safety in 10 Countries, is a project that is funded by the Bloomberg Philanthropies. Since that forms the background of this presentation, I'm going to describe what we are doing as part of that project. So the goal of the RS10 China project is to improve road safety through behavior change, legislative change, and improved enforcement. This work is happening in 10 countries. In China, the road safety interventions focus on controlling speeds and controlling drink driving. The work is being done in two cities, one of which is Dalian. And the work is being implemented. So the intervention is being implemented by the World Health Organization in partnership with local partners. So the timeline of the intervention, as you can imagine, the interventions that are happening is a complex mix of TV campaigns and trying to get police to do more enforcement. This little color bar that I have at the bottom is my attempt at trying to simplify that into giving a sense of what the strength of the interventions has been. And the main point of that color bar is that in the time period that we are talking about, the RS10 interventions weren't really doing much. There is one notable thing, and that is that starting in 2012, there was a national policy that went into place increasing speeding fines. The role of the group that I belong to at Johns Hopkins University is to evaluate whether the RS10 project is being effective or not. So we were in Dalian and Suzhou trying to measure speeds and drink driving, where we noticed something happen. And so it's really important to understand the intervention I'm talking about is not an RS10 intervention. We just happened to be in place with our measurement set up and noticed something interesting, which is what I'm describing today. So here is our measurement infrastructure that we've got in place in Dalian to measure speeds to evaluate the RS10 project. So since April 2011, we've done CAP surveys, knowledge, attitudes, and perception surveys. There have been six rounds of surveys in Dalian. It's not the main focus of what I'm talking about. The most important thing that I'm going to talk about are the observation studies. We've done nine rounds of speed measurements. Each round of speed measurement is about 8,000 cars are measured, and the speed is measured using handheld radar guns. And we also look at crash statistics from the police. So here is a map of Dalian showing you the location of the measurement sites. And so the measurement sites are distributed across the geography of the city where people live. And they're also picked to be a mix of highways and smaller roads. I've got one site circled in red, and that will be one of the sites we talk about in a little bit more detail in a second. So here's what we found. Our speed measurements over the last 2 years. On this graph, on the y-axis is the percentage of vehicles above the speed limit in Dalian. On the x-axis is time, starting from April 2011 till summer 2012. You see the graphs are in bands, so there's four bands over here. The red band is the percentage of vehicles that are 0 to 10% above speed limit. The blue band is 10 to 20%, and the purple band, the highest, is 20 to 30%. The remarkable thing about this band, about this graph, is that starting somewhere after 2012, there's a dramatic decline in the band above the red bands. So speeding in the 0 to 10% level is relatively flat, but then something happens which causes all speeding that is above 10% to decline dramatically. And so the question was, what happened? Because as far as we knew, we weren't doing much in the city as far as our interventions went as part of the RS10 project. And there is a national law that went into place for which increased speeding fines that's approximately targeted at the right time point. And the fact that all the declines happen for those speeding more than 10% above the speed limit is really sort of gives us a clue about this being about enforcement, because enforcement is usually done around the world for people who are traveling above a certain threshold of the speed limit, and the threshold is very often set about 10% above the speed limit. So we went digging into the data to try and figure out what happened. Here are the six sites at which we were doing measurements. I'm again showing you percentage of vehicles speeding, but this time we are showing you the data disaggregated by sites. And you can see that there's three curves in the bottom, which have always had relatively low levels of speeding. There's three curves on top, of which one curve has a dramatic decline starting around late 2011. And over a period of about 4 months, the number of vehicles speeding goes down from over 60% to less than 10%. And so the question was, what happened at this site? And I'm going to tell you what happened at this site. So this site is Donglian. It is a limited access highway. It's 11.3 kilometers long, six lanes highway, three in each direction. And for a highway, it has a relatively low speed limit of 60 kilometers per hour, which I think is around 40 miles per hour. On this highway, a interval-based speed enforcement system was installed, which I will describe a little bit more in a second. It uses 19 speed cameras in this zone. And the timing was such that installation began in August 2011, and they started testing it starting January 2012. And by April 2012, they were using it actively for enforcement. And as you would expect from a system like this, fines were given for people who were going more than 10% above the speed limit. So we've got our graphs showing declines in speeds. The anecdotal evidence from the police, which you should take with a grain of salt, is that before they used to have about 1,000 cars per day driving above the speed limit. Now that's down to about 100 cars per day. And before they used to have about 11 crashes per month in this zone. Now they have about 3 crashes per month in this zone. So this is what Donglian looks like. You can see it's a limited access highway. You're looking at an entry ramp. What the system does, as interval-based speed enforcement systems do, the system measures the average speed based on the time taken to travel the distance between two camera locations. So basically, as a car passes through the first camera location, a picture is taken and a timestamp is recorded. As the car passes the next camera, again a picture is taken and timestamp is recorded. And then the average speed is computed over that zone. And so if you went from one camera to the next in a time that was too short, then you were speeding over that entire zone. And so this is average speed calculation rather than instantaneous speed as is usually done with camera systems. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about the history of interval-based camera systems. These were first installed in the Netherlands in the late 1990s. By 2002, they had their first permanent installation, and now there's 11 permanent installations in the Netherlands. In England, the first trials were done in 1999, and the following year, they had their first full implementation, and from everything I hear, the UK has gone crazy putting up speed camera systems in general, but interval-based speed cameras also. So there's more than 80 in London. There's dozens of permanent sites, and many of them are used as temporary systems put around, for example, work zones. Italy has deployed over 200 on independent road stretches. Austria has four systems in place, and trials are currently underway in Belgium, Finland, France, Norway, Czech Republic, Spain, New Zealand, Australia. Did I just lose my microphone? All right. So you can probably see that there's one country noticeably missing from this list. And so that country is the United States. And based on the literature review that I was trying to do, there's hardly any talk about these types of systems or of speed camera systems much more broadly in the US. So China, which is what was the focus of our attention, has at least 13 systems. And so I know that because we did newspaper story searches. We couldn't find a central location to try and find out what they're doing with this technology. But newspaper stories suggest that there's 13 such systems currently deployed. Seven of those were deployed in the last year. So my point is that there's a huge growth in the use of this technology in China, but clearly in Europe as well, but not in the US so much. Okay, so I'm going to close by just giving you a brief review of speed enforcement systems. What's on this graph is, on this slide is an aggregation of a bunch of reviews that have been published about speed camera systems. There is one literature review that's been published on interval-based systems, which is where the information on the right-hand column is summarized from. That was in Accident Analysis and Prevention earlier this year by Sule et al. But there's a ton more published on instantaneous speed measurement systems, which is what we traditionally think about as speed enforcement systems. In fact, there's a Cochrane review from 2010, which reviewed about 30 studies and concluded that most of the studies were well designed and used and found really positive effects. And those effects are that instantaneous speed measurement systems manage to reduce average speeds very well. The same is true of interval-based speed enforcement systems. Instantaneous speed measurement systems reduce crash rates, usually. The same is true of interval-based systems, but we don't have enough evidence to show how well they do, meaning that there just aren't enough installations that have been evaluated yet. Noticeably, and very importantly, interval-based systems have a dramatic effect on reducing speed variance. And this, I was sort of amazed when we drove through Donglian, that we were on a wide highway and everybody was driving at the exact same speed as we were. So we were all going exactly the speed limit with everybody driving in sync. And that's sort of the effect that interval-based systems have, because everybody knows that you can't zoom around very much, so everyone drives at the same speed. And this has important co-benefits, which is improved traffic flow, because you can manage to reduce vehicle lead distance quite a bit. It reduces vehicular emissions because of reduced speeding up and slowing down. And it reduces fuel consumption for the same reason. And perhaps most importantly, the political acceptability seems to be higher for interval-based cameras. So one of the important reasons why people protest speed cameras is because they consider them unfair. So drivers seem to think that these speed cameras are deployed at places where people tend to speed, and they're deployed by government to raise taxes, so the government tries to find the best place where people are going to speed, and they put a single camera in place. Those arguments sort of go away with interval-based speed systems, because now we're talking of an entire zone, and nobody can really make the claim that they were accidentally speeding for a brief period of time when they were measured. So it seems like the political acceptability of the system is higher, but an important issue is that it can only be deployed in certain types of areas, while instantaneous speed systems can probably be deployed in a wider range of areas. Thank you. So, Ted?
As you say, it can only be employed in certain areas. I'm curious what the minimum distance that you need for the interval is.
So, I don't know the right answer to that question, but I do know it's deployed on the Tower Bridge in London. So that should give you a sense of how small that distance can be. This is an 11-kilometer stretch that we're talking about in China, so it can clearly be done on much longer stretches as well. Gordon?
What's the relative cost? Presumably there's big computers crunching, reading NUM plates automatically, and then moving things through the system.
So I don't think these technologies are so expensive anymore. I think the reason we are seeing this crazy growth in the use of these systems is because the technology to do for high resolution cameras coupled with optical character recognition has just gone crazy over the last couple of years. And so taking a high resolution picture is not difficult technology, and actually reading the license plate is very, very simple technology now. So I actually don't think that most of the cost comes from the technology per se, but nevertheless, I know that these systems are very expensive, and that's a big hurdle. The expense comes from the fact that they're going to be used for enforcement, and there's absolutely no chance you can take about them giving tickets to wrong people, because that completely destroys credibility of government. And so I think the companies that sell them tend to be large companies that have a long history of doing this sort of work, and that sort of drives up the price. You had a question.
From what I know, from what I understand, at least in the context of India, which is where I was looking, there hasn't really been any effort for other multinational corporations to take responsibility or to look to road traffic safety and with this level of attention. I think it probably happens though because the impetus was from the corporation when they were seeing that they had this highly trained workforce that was potentially not coming to work on time or not making it to work because they were injured or in a traffic crash. So it was almost like it required a economic perspective to engage the political will of a multinational corporation to be interested in implementing, although I'm sure they care about their employees, but to implement some sort of global road safety intervention that would work given these very different local contexts. Is that?
I'm glad you asked that. We didn't have information about the prescription use, so that wasn't something that we could do. But I do think that it should always be considered in terms of thinking about your results and as whether it's prescription or whether it's over-the-counter use of any kind of medication or substances. It's something to be considered, particularly in the causal pathway happening between post-traumatic stress disorder and motor vehicle crash hospitalizations, And if we had access to some other kinds of data with information about what alcohol content or prescription, then that would be really excellent for future studies to consider. But in the way that we looked at it with relative risk, because we considered it in the causal pathway, we wouldn't have adjusted for it as a covariate, but just something to consider qualitatively.
I have a question for Tom. It's interesting to say some of the fun things that people have done with the bicycle is that they look at the risk factors for the non-helmet protected injuries, just to see, and it might be a useful way of looking at, because there's always might be some differences in the types of crashes between the riders and things like that, and it might be reassuring to see that there was no difference in the risk estimates between, for example, ankle fractures or something like that, or some other injury.
Yeah, I fitted my models to extremity injury.
Yeah.
And there's nothing. I mean, the risk ratios are like 1.02, 1.01, all the way down to the different types. It's reassuring to see that.
Because some of the crashes could be more severe. You don't have the speed measurements.
Right. Yeah, what I'm expecting is that we'd see some probably strong effect modification by the collision type and the collision severity. I did look at speed, and I know that the difference in helmet performance disappears at really high speed. So if you're looking at riders who crash and they were doing 80 or greater, and they went up to like 115 or something, it doesn't matter what kind of helmet you're wearing. The risk of death is, you know, 60%, or it's just kind of shocking. Yeah, so I think we would see that when we have other measures of road type, the collision configuration, and estimate overall collision energy involved. Yeah, I'm looking forward to doing these analyses. It's going to be a lot of fun.
So I had a question about the non-standard helmet. Mm-hmm. Did it turn out that most non-standard helmets were cuff helmets?
Yes, but not all of them. About 85 to 90%. There were quite a few that had been coded by the officer as a three-quarter open. And anecdotally, I haven't seen a lot of three-quarter helmets that appear to be novelty.
So I guess the reason I'm asking that question is, what if instead of making this about certification, we made this about getting rid of half helmets? To what extent would we be making a big step towards reducing head injuries?
I think that would be a big step forward, but to do it you have to work with the US DOT, and I think it's clear to most people in my field that the US DOT has no interest in doing anything about motorcycle safety. They're not doing anything. They said in what, 2007 or 8, they had not a research agenda, but their motorcycle safety agenda, sort of a roadmap for what they wanted to do. And one of them was in the first couple of years, so I don't know, 2009 and 10, they were going to work to have the standard amended, and haven't done that. But I think they just are content to drag their feet.
It gets rid of the problem of police not being able to enforce because they can't look at whether it's.
Yeah, the question is, would riders, you know, you have this core group of riders and a pretty sizable majority ride Harleys, and almost the entire remainder ride cruiser-style kind of Japanese-made motorcycles that look kind of like Harleys. They're, you know, set up to capture some of that market. They're helmet-resistant for whatever reason, and they give you reasons, actually. We know a lot of their reasons, and freedom and personal choice, and they come up with other arguments that it reduces your hearing, your vision, there's a risk of neck injury. All of those excuses have been sort of refuted, but the personal freedom one is the most compelling argument that they have, and I can understand their argument. I can see both sides of it. I guess the question is, if you eliminated half helmets, would they find a three-quarter style helmet that is still a novelty helmet and makes them feel like they're resisting the government and doing what they want? Probably. So I think the way to move forward is to revise that standard, or you know, I don't, maybe California can come up with its own standard, but if they want to use the federal standard, that standard could be revised so that it says things like you need 1.25 inches of energy absorbing high density polystyrene. That's what makes it, instead of having the standard based on its performance during particular tests. Then law enforcement officers could actually make a determination that would withstand a court scrutiny. I can't see that happening anytime in the near future, but maybe.
Actually, one thing that I found notable there was that even the fake helmets provide some protection relative to no helmet. The confidence intervals didn't overlap, and I thought that was really something interesting.
Yeah, but that may go away when we get in some descriptors of the types of collisions. I really think those non-helmeted riders are riding in particular environments, roads that are typically considered off-road. Maybe they're doing on-off-road riding, but it's a public way, so they get included. When the CHP investigates their collision, I don't have much faith in that difference. I mean, the non-compliant helmets, based on this analysis, look like they perform better than no helmet. I don't really buy it.
It'd be interesting to see. Because from just basic biomechanics, having that even a non-compliant helmet would be a huge step against having nothing.
Yeah, I think so too.
Well, they don't have a capacity to absorb energy.
They do some energy, but not as much as the compliant helmet.
Yeah. So maybe we see some differences, particularly like lower speeds, lower severity collisions. Okay. We'll see. I'm open to, I have an open mind. I'll take whatever I can get. It'd be nice to learn that they do something. Of course, that would be an argument for just keeping them and not changing things.
It doesn't need to be
that. Things like a ski helmet or a horse riding helmet, and those are energy absorbent.
Yeah, we tend not to see a lot of those.
Yeah.
The helmet resistant riders want to wear a helmet that is not a helmet. It just kind of looks like it's a helmet and has a DOT sticker on the back. But yeah, an equestrian helmet or bicycle helmet, a football helmet, it would be better than nothing. You know, helmets are designed for particular ranges of impact. So a football helmet might be quite effective for collisions up to, up to 25 miles per hour, and then after that they become sort of useless. And the same for bicycle helmets. They'd be a lower threshold. And you can wear a helmet that's designed for motorcycling or auto racing that's designed for enormous impacts that wouldn't protect you very well in sort of standard traffic collision environments.
Well, it's 12, so I think we should officially close the session, but feel free to stay and mingle and meet and talk more. We'll see everybody in New Orleans next year. One really optimistic nugget that I'm leaving with today is this idea of trauma surgeons really trying to revive a body for 20 minutes. This is something nice to take home with me, so thank you for sharing that. All right, safe travels, everybody. We'll see you soon.